Hi everyone, and welcome to the first Quantum Gravity Seminar of this week. Today our speaker is Dawn Shook from Florida Atlantic University, and she will talk about complex critical exponents and curved geometries in Lorentzian EPRL streamform amplitude. And as usual, you can ask questions by raising your hand on Zoom or via the Google form to ask anonymous questions. And in particular, Dawn Shook is also fine with questions during the talk, so feel free to raise your hand also during her presentation. And with this, you can, Dawn Shook, you can start whenever you're ready.
Okay, thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you all for being here today. It's my pleasure to get to spend some time with you. Also, thanks to the organizers to offer me this opportunity to report my recent work. So this work is in collaboration with Muxin, Zichang, and Hong Guang. The related article can be found on archive now. So this is the plan of today's talk. First, I will introduce the motivation of this work and preview some results. Next, I will introduce the EPRL spinform model in details. And then I will talk about the real and the complex critical points in the EPRL spinform model. In the end, I will use Delta 3 and one file packed move to show our numerical result. So first is the motivation of this work and preview some results. As we know, the semi-classical consistency is an important requirement in loop quantum gravity. So today we will focus on four-dimensional Lorentzian EPRL spinform formulation. And the definition of the EPRL spinform models will be introduced in a moment. The semi-classical approximation gives us the large G asymptotics of the spinform amplitude, which has been extensively studied. There are many people contributing to this area. The asymptotics of the spinform amplitude relates to the Regi calculus. So we are going to use the numerical method to study the EPRL spinform amplitude. And recently, there are a lot of progress in numerics on spinform models. For example, the SL2C form library based on 15J symbol plus boosters, the spinform renormalization, the effective spinform model, and our previous work about asymptotic expansion of the vertex amplitude, and the spinform on the Lipschitz symbol by using the Monte Carlo computation to calculate the spinform propagator. So we extend our previous method in the last item to study to calculate the asymptotic expansion of the spinform amplitude on the simplicial complex. When we consider the spinform amplitude on the simplicial complex by taking into account some over G, there is an argument that the EPRL spinform amplitude seems to be nominated only by flat Regi geometries in the semi-classical regime. This is called the flatness problem. And I will come back to give some details about the flatness problem in a moment. But actually, this argument is not true because we found some curved geometries and our numerical results prove this curved geometry's contribution to the spinform amplitude is not small. I use this graph to show this result. So this horizontal axis is deficit angle, and this vertical axis is proportional to the amplitude. This green point is the amplitude at the flat geometry. These red points are the amplitude at the curved geometries. So you can see in this region, the amplitude at the curved geometries are comparable to the amplitude at the flat geometry. So even in this lowest point, the amplitude at the curved geometries is still around 0.5. So it means the amplitude at the curved geometries are not small. In spin form, the large spin parameter lambda is a finite expansion parameter. So we want so then for any large but finite lambda, there always exist relatively small deficit angles such that the amplitude is not small. And in the parameter space, we also found some non-blue regimes. These non-blue regimes contain the curved geometries, and the amplitude of the curved geometries are not small. So we want to show these curved geometries come from the complex critical point. And the complex critical points have been overlooked by the argument of the flatness problem. And
question by Bianca?
Yeah, right.
Are you coming back to the graphics on the previous?
Mm-hmm. This slide? One?
Yeah.
Oh, this one. Okay.
No, are you, is that going to appear again?
This one? You mean
no, this one. I have a question to that, but now people won't understand.
Oh yes, I will give the details. So now you can just consider it's like a parameter space, and blue regime, the amplitude is zero. But for this non-blue regime, you can see this number are the amplitude.
I have a question, in particular here, because but it's probably already taking something which you will say,
mm-hmm.
because you will say you should look for critical points in the complex plane.
Yes.
So yeah. My question was, is whether you compute whether these deficit angles shouldn't be also complex or have an imaginary part, and how big this imaginary part is.
Actually, I think later I will go through all this. So okay. Here, I just want to introduce the motivation of this work, and all your questions will be answered in a moment, I think. Okay, so I just want to show where these curved geometries come from, and they are come from the complex critical points, and I use this simple example to show what's going on here. So this is a simple example. You can see it's just a one-dimensional simple integral. And if r equal to zero, it's just the oscillatory Gaussian integral. And here r is just the parameters. And the action here is I times x squared minus r times x plus one squared. So this is the action. From this action, we can solve the critical point. And this is a critical point. And you can see there are two cases. If this r equal to zero, then this critical point is just a zero. So it's a real critical point. If r not equal to zero, then you can see this critical point is complex. So we got the complex critical point. And as a simple integral, actually we can calculate this amplitude directly. So this is the amplitude. And compared to the initial integrand, we just replace this x by the critical point xc. And then we let lambda equal to 100, got this absolute value, or we plot the absolute value of the amplitude as a function of r. This point is r equal to zero. So it's the amplitude at the real critical point. And these are the amplitude at the complex critical points. So you can see the amplitude at these complex critical points are not small. It's similar to our result. Let's come back to our result. So then you can see this amplitude at the flat geometry correspond to the real critical point. And this amplitude at complex at the curved geometries correspond to the complex critical points. And the amplitude at these curved geometries correspond to the complex critical points are not small. So here, I just want to use this simple example to show how what's the relation between the complex critical points and the curved geometries. And the similar ideas already appeared in this work. So our result, numerical result, also makes the cosine problem relaxed for the delta 3 triangulation. And for one file packed mu, we numerically reduced the spin form amplitude to the integral over the Ragi geometries. So this is the integral over the Ragi geometries. And we got the effective action is the Ragi action plus something looks like the high curvature correction. So this is the preview of our results. And now let's talk about this in details. So there are many types of spin forms. What we use here today is the EPRL spin form. So in the four-dimensional triangulation, there are four simplices, the four simplex, tetrahedra, and the triangles. In its dual complex, the vertex dual four simplex due to four simplex, the oriented edges due to tetrahedra, the oriented faces due to triangles. So there are two types of faces. One, they are on the boundaries. So we call it boundary faces. We use V to label them. The other types are shared by the four simplices. So they are the internal faces. We use H to label them. A spin form ascends an SU2 spin to each face. So then there are two types of spins, the boundary spin JB and the internal spin JH. The spin form amplitude can be written in the integral representation with the spin form action. So this is the spin form action. And the summed variables are the internal spins. The integrated variables are SL2C group variables and the spinners, ZVF, the spinner belongs to CP1. Here, JB, CEB, they are the boundary state. So the boundary state are not summed or integrated. So we can consider them as the parameters. Here, only the internal spins are summed, not the boundary spins. This is a detailed expression of the spin form action. And the spin form action has the continuous gauge freedom. So we need to do the gauge fixing. For each spinner, there is scaling gauge freedom. So we fix the first component of the spinner to be one. And for each vertex, there is continuous SL2C gauge freedom. So we choose one of the group element to be identity. And at each edge, there is SU2 gauge freedom. So we choose GV prime this E along this edge to be the upper triangular matrix. Then we have the following real parametrization. And we parametrize the group element and the spinners as this. So here, this G naught and alpha naught, they are the real variables. And the G naught and the alpha naught, they will be the critical point of the action. And I want to stress here, all this X and Y, they are the real variables. Then at this moment, we got the spin form action. Actually, it is a function in terms of this X, Y, and the GH, these real variables. And then the spin form action will be the analytic continued to the holomorphic function. All these variables will be complex variables. And the in-loop quantum gravity by the area spectrum, so this is the area spectrum, the classical area is much greater than the Planck length square, which implies this spin should be large. This motivates us to understand this large G regime as the semi-classical regime. So to prove the semi-classical regime, we scale both the boundary and the internal spins by using this parameter lambda, and the lambda much greater than one. Then we applied the Poisson summation. We got the EPIL spin form amplitude. Here, this is the EPIL spin form amplitude. And you can see this integrated variables are the internal spins became the integrated variables. And the internal spins are continuous. So next, let's come to the real and complex critical point in the EPIL spinform model. The integral in the spinform amplitude then has this simplified form. And here, this R is the boundary state. We call GB and CEB. This is the action. And here, all these variables are integration variables. They are real variables. The real critical point will be the solution of the critical equation. So here, this is a critical equation, and the derivative or action with respect to this x, y, and the internal spins. This solution gives us the rigid geometries. This rigid geometry subject to the flatness constraint. So when we solve this critical equation, we will get the flatness constraint. This is a flatness constraint. And this flatness constraint seems to tell us the spinform amplitude is dominated only by the flat rigid geometries in the semi-classical regime. Technically, actually, there are geometries that the gamma multiplied by delta H is equal to 4 pi times the positive or negative integers. But the generic curved geometry nearby these geometries will be suppressed. So here we only focus on the curved geometries nearby the flat geometry. So then let's come to a concrete example to show how the boundary data determine the geometries. We use this delta three triangulation to show how the boundary data determine the rigid geometry. So this is the delta three triangulation. We have.
Can I ask a question? Because I just about on the previous slide. So the action is actually complex.
Yes, the action is complex.
So I'm wondering how we got to that point, because then you have complex critical points. It's kind of natural.
Also here, we solve for the real critical point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, can you explain why we only look for real critical points if the action was complex?
Because here, the integral here is in the real integration domain. So here we look for the real critical point, which lies in the real integration domain. And this real critical point satisfies this real critical equations. That's the reason we are looking for the real critical
point. Okay. Well, yeah, it's clearly something wrong to do because there's a simple example that shows that it doesn't work.
Yes, okay. So first we look for the real critical point, but at some case we couldn't find the real critical point. The next step, we are going to find the complex critical points.
Okay, thanks.
So I use this slide to want to show how the boundary data determine the rigid geometries. And this is the delta three triangulation. We have three full simplices. They share an common internal face. This is the common internal face. So then you can see all the edges, they are on the boundary. And the boundary edge lengths will determine the rigid geometries on delta three. It means the boundary data JB CEB determine the boundary edge lengths. And then this boundary edge lengths determine the rigid geometry, GOR. So all the tetrahedra and the triangles we use here are space-like. Then we know, okay, the boundary data will determine the geometries. So there are two regimes. The first regime, if we fix the boundary data, which admits a flat geometry, then we can use the asymptotic expansion to expand this integral. We got this expansion, and you can see the dominant contribution from the real critic point. This x naught is the real critic point. The second regime, we fix the boundary data, but that boundary data gives us the curved geometries. It means there is no real critical point. In this case, the amplitude will be suppressed and is exponentially suppressed. So in the first regime, the amplitude will be parallel decay. But in the second regime, the decay is exponential decay. So it means if we want to vary this boundary data, then we need an interpolation between the first regime and the second regime in order to clarify the contribution from the curved geometries. So here we introduce the use of the complex critical point. Then what is the complex critical point in the EPIL spinform model? Here we consider the large lambda integral. So this is a large lambda integral. If it's a delta three triangulation, then the dimension is 124. Here, this is the action and this mu ox, both of them are analytic function for the boundary data R belongs to U, X, the variables belongs to K. Then U cross K is a compact neighborhood of R naught and X naught. Here, R naught is the flat geometry. X naught is the corresponding real critical point. Then we can do the analytic extension to X and the action. So we got the complex variable C and the analytic continued function, this action. Then the complex critical points, this C of R, are the solutions of the complex critical equation. This is the complex critical equation. Okay, let me use this graph to show what's the relation between the real critical point and the complex critical point. So when the geometry R is equal to R naught, it's the flat geometry. Then we have the real critical point X naught. Then if we deform this R from R naught, the real critical point will move smoothly from the X, the real axis, to the complex component. So this is the relation between the real critical point and the complex critical point.
Okay, I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I understand historically that we came from real critical points and mm-hmm. now we complexify. But in some sense, you just have a complex action and you should look for complex critical points in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Is it really necessary to always attach everything to the real critical point?
Or is
it a technical tool to then also decide which critical point in the complex plane contributes?
Right. Actually, what we start is from the real critical point, the flat geometry, because at first we focus on the flat geometry, which gives us the real critical point. And then, so the whole motivation of this work, we want to find the amplitude from the curved geometries.
So yeah, I'm just saying it's not really necessary to start from the flat point. I understand the point. It's a complex critical point.
Yeah,
which of course we also found.
Mm-hmm.
If one has a complex action, one mm-hmm. one doesn't need first to identify any real critical points and then analytically continue. But then in the complex plane, since we have also done Lifshitz, there might be more critical points. And then there's also a question which points contribute. So I'm asking if that is possibly a technique to say that this one should really contribute.
So you mean we can start from a random curved geometries and the.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, then you have just critical points in the complex plane.
Yes, that's right. But I couldn't find the, you know, the boundary data will fix the whole geometry and the spin form amplitude will depends on the triangulation, like the triangulation we choose. So here we need a start point. So what all this perturbation is based on that start point. So here what we choose is from the flat geometry, but maybe it's also a good point that we choose like a curved geometries with the small deficit angle with the starting point. I think it's also possible, but
It's not, I mean, actually, you know, you have the theory of Lifshitz symbol for the complex plane that allows to just consider a complex action without any critical points or one parameter deformations.
Yeah, that's true. So it's possible, like we start with curved geometries with the small deficit angles and that correspond to a complex grid point and we start from there. But here, what I want to do is just to compare the flat geometries and the curved geometries to compare the real grid point and the complex grid point. But you are right, we can start from the curved geometries. Mm-hmm.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. And anyways, here I just want to show what is the complex grid points in the EPIL spin form model. And then once we have the complex grid points, we can use the large lambda asymptotic expansion for this integral. And this is the large lambda asymptotic expansion. You can see the left hand is the integral in the real integration domain. And the right hand side, the expansion, the dominant contribution are from the complex grid point. So it means we found the interpolation between the two regimes that we just mentioned earlier. So the first regime, if the geometry give us the flat geometry, then the real critical point at the real part of the action at the real critical point is zero. So this amplitude will be power law decay. But if R is not R naught, which gives us the curved geometries, then the real part of the action at the complex critical point will be less than zero. So here we will have a damping factor. This exponential of lambda times the real part of the action at the complex critical point. So here, an important mark here is this 1/lambda, we can consider it as a finite expansion parameter, like h bar in the quantum mechanics. Although h bar in the quantum mechanics is dimensionful, once we choose the finite unit, this h bar is just a small number, and we never let h bar equal to zero. So similarly here, we never let this lambda to be infinity. Then given any lambda, as long as it's finite, this damping factor may not be small. So for example, if we choose this real part of the action at the complex critical point is equal to -1/lambda, then this damping factor is just equal to e to the -1, which is not a small number. So now let's use the delta 3 triangulation first to show our numerical result. So this is a review of the delta 3 triangulation. We already know the boundary data will determine the Ragi geometry. And there are three forcing places. They share a common internal phase. So first, we numerically construct the boundary data and get the flat geometry. This flat geometry will give us the real critical point. So this has the data for the boundary data and the real critical point. Next, we vary this length, the length between 2 and 6. It will give us a family of boundary data. And this boundary data will give us the curved geometries, this GR. So this is the range or the length variation and the corresponding depth theta angles. Then for each depth theta angle not equal to zero, the real critical point will be absent. So we need to numerically compute the complex critical point, ZOR. This ZOR satisfied the complex critical equation. And here we use the Newton-like recursive procedure to calculate the complex critical point. So these are the steps how to calculate the complex critical point. So first we linearize this complex critical equation at this pseudo X naught. This X naught, I will call it a pseudo critical point because this X naught satisfies the real, at this X naught, it satisfies the real part of the action is equal to zero. And the derivative of the action with respect to G and Z are equal to zero. But the derivative of the action with respect to the internal spins are not equal to zero. So I call this X naught is the pseudo critical point. Then we can get the solution. We call it Z1. Next, we linearize this complex critical point at Z1. Then the solution is Z2. So we keep linearizing the complex critical equation until we got the approximate solution. We call this is the approximate complex critical points, Zn. So Zn is equal to Zn minus 1 plus delta Zn. Practically, in our code, we only repeat these steps four times. So here, n is equal to 4. Then we want to measure the error. So we define the absolute error by using the by using this form. Because we want to solve the complex critical points and make this equal to zero. So we define the absolute error as the maximum value of the derivative action at the complex critical points. And you can see this absolute error actually is related to the depth theta angle and how many times we repeat the whole steps. And here I list a part of the result, the depth theta angles and the corresponding absolute error. So you can see,
thanks. So initially it seems that you can satisfy all equations on real, for real data, except the one with respect to the spin. Well, that's where we start with. So in the solutions are all variables complexified, or is it mostly the spin J, H?
At the beginning, we use this X naught. This X naught is real. So it's the real pseudo critical point. And then after the first time, this solution will be the complex solution. But this error is large, so we repeat the whole steps many times, and then we got the approximate complex.
Yeah, no, I understood that. I'm asking because initially you actually start with this X naught, and that X naught satisfies all variational equation.
Okay, except this one.
The one with the spin.
It's the internal spins.
Yeah, with respect to the internal spin.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm asking about the solution, the critical point you get in the end. Is there a non-vanishing imaginary part for all variables, or is it mostly for the spin?
It satisfied all the spins. So we will put this, okay, so in the end, I will put this complex, the approximate complex critical points inside this to test the real part of the action.
I'm asking is in the end for Z4.
Yes, in the end.
So your little Z4 or your little Zn, I guess, because it's really it's some number in C in 124 dimensional complex space.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm asking about is the complex or is the imaginary part for the variables which describe the spin? I assume there's an imaginary part which for the variables which describe the internal spin.
Mm-hmm.
And how does that compare to the imaginary part for your solution for the variables which describe the group element and Z, the other Z, the Z which were the 3D angles?
3D.
The Z you have here, you have two Zs, which is anyway. Go on, please.
Actually here, what we just did to do to linearize this complex critical equation and want to solve this critical equation, get a complex critical points. And here in the end, actually we can increase the whole steps to get more accurate answers. And we only use 4 times. It's enough because you can see this error is small enough. But actually you can also increase the whole steps to get a better complex critical points. Mm-hmm. And then, okay. Yes.
So now I can possibly, because you give delta H.
Delta H is the deficit angle.
Mm-hmm.
And this N is a file because here we use the repeating times, it's 4 times. Okay. If it's like 5 times, then this order, this power will be 6.
But this delta H does depend on JH.
It depends on the boundary data. So each time when we change the boundary data, then this deficit angle will change.
But in principle, it should also depend on JH, no? Because that is the internal area, and the internal area changes, then the deficit angle will change.
The radiation will depend on the JH times the deficit angles. But I don't think this deficit angle will depend on the GH. So I mean
it depends on how you compute it. That's
right here, what we compute here,
you can compute it from by using
the normals. So what we calculated here, the deficit angles, we use the normals to calculate the deficit angle.
But then these normals also include variables you integrate over. I'm basically asking in the end, why should delta H, this deficit angle, not be complex?
Delta H here is real, not complex.
Okay.
Yeah.
But if you compute delta on the critical point, which is complex, how is it not complex? Are you using delta just from the boundary data, basically?
Yeah. So here, this delta is just from the boundary data. And we use this delta to defend the radiation. And this deficit angle are real deficit.
Okay. Okay. Mm-hmm. Then it's a question basically for more complicated solutions. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe then what you could do at some point is to use an alternative definition of delta, which would involve.
Yes, maybe I can introduce.
Mm-hmm. Involve JH, for instance, and then my question would be: how large is the imaginary part of this delta H?
Okay.
Because in a sense, here you can just define it from the length on the boundary, of course.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm. And for this page, we use this method to numerically compute the complex critical points. And then once we have the complex critical points for this many different curved geometries, we can evaluate the action at this complex critical point. So this X, this S is the action at these complex critical points. And we also define this delta I. This delta I is the difference between the action and the radiation. So this is the radiation. And the radiation is equal to the internal areas times the deficit angle plus the sum of the boundary data's the boundary triangles area times the dihedral angles. So then you can see the radiation are real. If we multiply this radiation with this imaginary unit, then you can see the real part of the action will come from the real part of delta I. So then we have this graph. The horizontal axis is the deficit angle. The vertical axis is exponential to exponential of lambda times the real part of delta I, also the real part of the action. And this one, the vertical axis will be proportional to the amplitude. So this green point is the amplitude at the flat geometry. We got it from the real critical point. And these red points are the amplitude at the curved geometries. And we got these curved geometries from the complex critical points. And in this region, you can see the amplitude of these curved geometries are not small. Even the lowest point is still around 0.5. So you can see the amplitude at these curved geometries are comparable to the amplitude at the flat geometry.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask, why did you choose such a high lambda?
We can also choose the 10 to the 5 or 6, but the graph looks, so this part will not be stable like this, longer like this, so we choose 10 to the 11. Now, of course, we can also choose 10 to 5 or 10 to 4.
Okay, but if you choose 10 to the 4, shouldn't it be allowing larger deficit angles?
Yes, that's true. Larger deficit angles.
Mm. Okay, because I believe we choose much smaller lambda and we could realize quite large deficit angles.
Oh, right. Yes, and we can also.
Yeah, you know, you have this minuscule deficit angles, you know, very small.
Okay. Oh, here, actually, initially we want to show even for the large lambda, there are still the curved geometries.
Okay.
So here we choose the large lambda.
Uh-huh.
Yes, that's the reason.
Uh-huh.
And then actually here, this blue curve is the best fit function. So we got the best fit function, the delta I as a function of the deficit angles. And this AI are the best fit coefficients. And we also get the corresponding fitting errors. You can see the best fit errors, they are small. So it means this best fit function are trustable. And
Make a fit and as a function of gamma?
We did it. Mm-hmm. And actually later I will show you the upper bound. That upper bound is similar, it's consistent with the effective spin form model. So we also did the best fit function with gamma, and it's similar to this one. Okay, so here, this is the best fit function. And so at this point, we got the effective action, and this effective action is the radiation. This radiation plus the Heckrich correction. This delta I is the Heckrich correction. And we also have the counterplot of the amplitude as a function of the deficit angle and the lambda. This one we fix the gamma equal to 0.1. And this blue region, it means the amplitude at zero. And this non-blue region means the contains the curved geometries. And you can see these amplitudes are not small. So we use this counterplot to show this non-blue region contains the curved geometries, and these curved geometries are not small. As long as this lambda are finite, these deficit angles are not vanishing. And then we also have the counterplot of the amplitude as a function of gamma and the deficit angles. So you can see we also have the non-blue regime. And besides, we also find the range of the deficit angles are enlarged if we make this gamma small. So, but anyways, we want to use these two graphs to show there are curved geometries, and this curved geometry's amplitude are not small. Our numerical result also makes the cosine problem relaxed. So naively, for the cosine problem, we can see the amplitude for the delta three triangulation may contain 8 terms. And I think there is a question.
There is a question by Hank. Yes, Hank, go ahead.
Yeah, so I'm just wondering, maybe it's a naive question. I'm just wondering, like the previous result where you showed that there are curved geometries showing up as critical points, right?
Yes, critical point. So
yeah, complex critical points. So I was just wondering, like, because the dip in the curve that you gave where you have the blue curve and
this
the
one?
Red dots, yeah.
Yeah.
That looks like some kind of order parameter. So is it like, don't we understand this as some sort of phase transition?
The phase transition, sorry, I'm not sure. Because we haven't talked about this like similar with the phase transition thing.
Mm-hmm. I see. Yeah. Well, it's just that, like, for example, if you compute the amplitude,
mm-hmm.
And then you take the derivative with respect to boundary spins, or maybe derivative with respect to lambda or gamma.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'll see like a discontinuity or something. Maybe I don't know.
Maybe. Yeah. Maybe it's related to the phase transition, but I'm not sure actually. So
okay, thank you.
No problem. And we can continue talk about the cosine problem. So for the amplitude of the delta three triangulation, it may contain 8 terms because each vertex will give us one positive radiation and one negative radiation. So it may contain 8 terms. And these 8 terms correspond to 2 continuous full simplex orientation and 6 discontinuous full simplex orientation. So when we talk about consider the orientation in the full on the full simplex, then the flatness constraint should change to this form. This S are positive or negative, which means the opposite orientation. And this delta HS, I will call it orientation dressed deficit angles. Then for a given boundary data, these are not, we numerically compute the deficit, different orientations corresponding orientation dressed deficit angles. And we found only these 2 continuous orientation gives us the deficit angle equal to 0. The other 6 discontinuous orientation, the corresponding the deficit angles are not equal to 0. All the orientation dressed the deficit angles are not equal to 0. So it means only these 2 continuous orientation gives us the real critical point. Then we can get the asymptotic expansion of the amplitude for delta three triangulation at this moment. So this is the asymptotic expansion. And here this IR is the radiation. This delta I and the delta I prime correspond to two different complex critical points. And these two complex critical points correspond to that two real critical points with the continuous orientation. And this is a high curvature correction for delta I and the delta I prime. And from this asymptotic expansion, the cosine problem is relaxed for the delta three triangulation. So in the last section, I will talk about Van Fell-Packed Mu in the numerical result for the Van Fell-Packed Mu. So Van Fell-Packed Mu is refining one full simplex into five full simplexes by inserting internal set, this 0.6. And the simplicial complex for Van Fell-Mu, there is an internal set, this 0.6, and the five internal segments, these red segments are the internal segments, 10 boundary triangle and the 10 internal triangles. So for example, this 1, 2, 3, 1, 4, 5, they are the boundary triangles. And this 1, 2, 6 or 1, 3, 6, they are the internal triangles. We use H to label the internal triangles. Then the Ryzhi geometry of the Van Fell-Mu are determined not only by the boundary data, but also including this five internal lenses. So because we only focus on the neighborhood of the real critical point, and in that real critical point, we can locally change the variables from the internal lens to the internal areas by using the Heron's formula. So here, we choose this five internal areas. For example, this J12 means the triangle area for 1, 2, 6, triangle 1, 2, 6. And then for the Van Fell-Mu spin form amplitude, if we consider the real critical point of the flat geometry, that real critical point will be degenerate because of the freedom of this 0.6. But we want to generalize our previous method to Van Fell-Mu. So here what we did, we extract or separate these five internal areas as the integrated variables for the amplitude. And we define this integrand, this Z, a sigma 1,5. And inside this Z sigma 1,5, there are integrated variables for the other five internal areas. We use this H bar to label the other five internal triangle areas. Then we focus on the 195 dimensional integral in Z, not in the amplitude anymore. And for this Z, the external parameters R will contain these five J's and the boundary data. This R naught will determine the flat geometry. And in Z, we will get the non-degenerate real critical point with the continuous orientation. If we fix the boundary data, intuitively we deform this internal segment length. And if we deform this internal segment lenses, the internal triangle area will deform. So because these internal areas are the parameters in R, so it means this R will deform. And here, all this deformation, we use the random sampling. Then, because we calculated the real non-degenerate real critical point for Z, so the resulting Hessian in Z will be non-degenerate. And there is only one degree of freedom in R, and we got the corresponding curved geometries with the smart deficit angles. And all these smart deficit angles are less than 10 to the negative three. And at this moment, the real critical point will be absent. Although the one fell moon are the complicated complex, but we can still use the previous method to calculate the complex critical points. So we numerically compute the complex critical point for many different curved geometries and evaluate the action. We also get the similar result to with delta three triangulation. Here, this vertical axis is proportional to z sigma one phi, and the horizontal axis is delta. Delta is the average of the 10 deficit angles. So this is still the amplitude at the flat geometry, and these are the amplitude at the curved geometries. In one fell moon, we also found the non-blue regimes contain the curved geometries, and these curved geometries are not small.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Here? So if you consider this 5-1 Pachner move, mm-hmm. So I think you have Lorentzian data.
Yes, it's Lorentzian.
It's also Lorentzian boundary and so on.
Yes, also Lorentzian boundary.
So in that case, actually, the integration regime for the internal edges is really infinite.
Mm-hmm.
And you can even consider something quite homogeneous, and you can still have an infinite range for the internal edges.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe what happens is that the curvature gets larger and larger.
Mm-hmm.
But if I look at your picture, if one would still integrate that, you get still quite a strong cutoff. You do allow some curvature, but it's still quite cut off at, I don't know, in this case, 10 minus 4.
Mm-hmm. The deficit angle.
The deficit angle. Mm-hmm. So it's with gamma equal to 1 is maybe also quite large, and 10 mm-hmm. to the 11 is quite large. So, but what my point is that you're not really reproducing length ratchet calculus because you have this cutoff.
Mm-hmm.
Can you comment on that? I mean, in length ratchet calculus, you would have really an infinite integral and actually here we didn't
calculate the amplitude. We calculated the vertical is proportional to this z, not the amplitude.
Yeah. No, but it would mean since z goes to zero that
mm-hmm. So
I mean, then in addition, you would kind of integrate over these parameters which you now kept in real. No?
So in the end, we will insert this z into the amplitude, and this integral will be the integral over all the regular geometries, and this will be from zero to infinity.
Yeah, and I mean in Recce case, this mm-hmm. integral is usually kind of over an infinite range.
Mm-hmm.
And you do integrate also over arbitrary large curvatures.
Yes, yes, that's
but
true.
You do implement because you do implement, you do have quite a strong curvature cutoff.
Mm-hmm. Right. So we have here we didn't introduce any cutoff because we only focus on that z. But
I don't mean that you introduce it. You have a cutoff just from the previous graph
mm-hmm.
because it goes to the amplitude.
Mm-hmm.
I mean the absolute value of your amplitude.
Mm-hmm.
But it goes basically to zero if your curvature is larger than 10 to the minus.
Yes, four. Yes. If it's beyond that bound, then the curve it will surprise. The amplitude will surprise.
Yeah. So yeah. You can, yeah. And so I'm saying it, this is quite different from length stretching.
It's different from the length stretching
case because you don't have this strong fall off suddenly.
I'm not sure.
Okay, anyway.
So because here we didn't introduce any cutoff because here we first fix the boundary data.
I'm not saying that you introduce a cutoff.
Mm-hmm. But and you mean if
you do get a cutoff
mm-hmm.
on the integral you show on the next slide, which is over the internal edge length.
Yes.
Because the Ratchet action for at least expressed in these edge lengths,
mm-hmm.
well, it tells you will get quite large curvature, but for that your amplitude here will be basically zero.
Yes, that's true.
And so is that good or bad?
I won't say it's good or bad because if the deficit angle beyond that bound, of course that amplitude will surprised. And this reg internal this reg geometry, this internal length can be from zero to infinity. Right. So I won't say it's a good thing or bad thing, but it's normal that the deficit angle, if the deficit angle beyond that bound, the amplitude depressed, the suppressed.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I want to show here. It's so here I give the amplitude, all the z, this vertical axis proportional to z. And once the deficit angle larger than this point, then the whole amplitude or the whole z will depressed. And then we insert this z back into the amplitude. We got this integral over the whole radi geometries. And this is the radi geometry, the integral over the radi geometries. And the same thing, we also got the radi action. The action plus is equal to the radi action plus the high curvature correction. Mm-hmm. And this is the high curvature correction. And our numerical result also get the best fit coefficient. And the numerical result also gives us this upper bound. So this bound is consistent with the effective spin form model, which is given by CSU and Hall in 2020. So then I believe this bound should be violated to all the spin form amplitude in general. So that's the whole point for this sigma 1-5 model.
You believe it should be violated or?
Should be violated to all the spin form amplitude, this bond. Do you think so?
No, I don't. Why should it be violated?
It's a violate to all the spin form amplitude.
Validated.
Yes, okay. Violate to.
Okay, now.
okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And this is the upper bound we got in the both the delta three triangulation and the 1-5.
Well, actually, when we did consider an example with more than one internal triangle, we found that we can overcome this regime. That is, we still got curvature and non-suppressed. Well, the amplitudes can be suppressed, but the observables we got, the expectation values, they're still reproducing curved geometries.
Mm-hmm.
Even so, we violated this bound. So there might be additional mechanisms.
Okay.
at play. But for one triangle, and this is more or less derived for one triangle. For one triangle, this bound holds really.
You mean one internal spins?
Yeah, if one has just one triangle, but we also saw that if one has like in our case we had three internal integrations, and you only integrate over the spins, and do not have what you call that at some point.
Sorry, I would suggest that answer the presentation or go toward the conclusion, and then we can continue the discussion after she finishes her presentation.
Yes, it's almost done. So this is a summary of today's talk. So what we have is the EPR spin form amplitudes should allow the radial geometries with the small deficit angles. And we also have the curved geometries, which correspond to the complex critic points. And these complex critic points are slightly away from the real integration domain. And the radial geometries with the small deficit angles are sufficient for approximating the arbitrary smooth curved geometries. And our numerical result also show the dominant contribution to the spin form amplitude is proportional to E, the exponential of the action. And here the effective action is the radial action plus the high curvature correction. And our numerical result makes the delta three triangulation, the cosine problem, relaxed. And for one file packed move, in the end, we numerically reduced the spin form amplitude to the integral over the radial geometries. And for the outlook, maybe we can compare the large J behavior with in the EPR spin form model with the effective spin form model. And our numerical methods can also be applied to the observables, for example, the correlation functions. And we can also apply this method to the more complicated complex. And maybe we can also apply it to analyze the lattice refinement and calculate the larger deficit angles and the higher order corrections. So that's all. Thank you.
Thank you for the very nice talk. Are there more questions, in particular from students? Ding.
Thank you, Alessia, and
thank you,
Dongxue, for the nice talk. I have a naive question. So I'm interested in quantum Regi calculus, and I wonder where do I see the difference if I say take two approaches: first, do the spin foam path integral, and second, do the quantum Regi calculus path integral. In which regime would I expect to see some differences?
So for here I focus on the semi-classical regime. So for the semi-classical regime, then we focus on the large G regime. Then the Regi geometries, all the Regi geometries we have here is the large G, and we use the lambda to permit the large lambda to do all the analysis. So this is what we focus on, but I'm not sure for your case, which part you focus on.
I guess in quantum Regi calculus, perhaps, by semi-classical regime, I'm guessing what would that mean in quantum Regi calculus case? So how would you transcribe your context of semi-classical regime in quantum Regi calculus case? Is it for the boundary data?
Yes, so here we want to find the consistency between the loop quantum gravity and with the GR, So this flatness problem is an argument that if a flatness problem was true, then it means the loop quantum gravity, especially the spinform model, is not consistent with the GR. So it means it's wrong in the classical regime, semi-classical regime. So here we want to confirm that the flatness problem is wrong, that actually there is no flatness problem. So then we focus on the semi-classical regime. Now the if in the semi-classical regime, our result is consistent with the GR, then it means the spinform model is good enough. Mm-hmm. So then in the spinform model, especially the EPRL spinform model, if we focus on the semi-classical regime, we can focus on the large G regime because of the error spectrum. So here, why we focus on the large G regime? Because of the error spectrum. So that's the reason.
I see. So perhaps in the quantum magic calculus case, you're considering large area boundary data and like maybe simple.
So we fix the boundary data first, and that boundary data here we choose the large area, and then we choose different triangulations.
Yes, I guess the point is that you don't see a difference in this regime between the two theories. So then the question is, when would you expect to start to see a difference? Should I lower the boundary areas for that to happen?
That depends on the, I think it depends on, so I think maybe your question is, it's asking me like which regime is the large J regime. So how large for J is this your question?
I'm more wondering what the physical differences are between these two theories, or are there any physical differences at all?
Between
quantum magic calculus and spin forms.
Between the Regi calculus and the, so in the end, if we want to prove the spin form model is good enough, it should be consistent with the Regi geometry, the Regi calculus in the classical regime.
So what I mean is quantum Regi calculus. You know, we can take Regi geometries and do a path integral over these geometries.
Mm-hmm.
And you got a quantum theory of gravity.
Okay.
And this, in principle, could be different from spin form as a theory of quantum gravity.
Oh.
So I'm asking about maybe where do I see the difference? Oh, do I expect to see any difference between these two theories? And if so, in which regime?
Sorry, I'm not sure about that part, the okay. Quantum Regi geometries.
Okay, no problem. Thank you. It's a nice talk. Thank you.
Are there other questions?
Yeah, I have a question on the behavior in gamma.
Okay, maybe I can.
At some point, you have this expansion and higher curvature, and you have these coefficients.
So maybe this one?
Yeah, so in general, at some point you had also these like A and so on. I mean, in general, your complex, your imaginary part of the action is linear in gamma. So, you had this on the previous, the slide you had before that. Yeah, here you have A2, A3, and
Yes, A4. We do the best fit function between this delta I and the deficit angles. But actually, we also fit this delta I with the gamma. And actually, it has a similar result with this one. As a delta I equal to AI times gamma square plus the gamma cube. But here we will fix the deficit angle first.
Yeah, and okay, if you fix a deficit angle, so because you said gamma square, is that the lowest power or does it start linearly in gamma?
Because this delta I is the action minus the Regi action. So here the first the first order for delta I is equal to gamma square.
Can you say it as a reason again?
Because this the rejection will include
the first
order.
Okay, this includes the part which is linear in gamma. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And
this delta I will be the R square. So will be equal to AI times the R, A2 times the R square plus A3 times the R cube, this delta I.
But there is already kind of a real part which comes from the rejection itself.
The real part, yes, the real part will be
not the rejection, the spin formation itself. Mm-hmm. There's already this part, okay.
Yes.
Which is linear in gamma.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Okay. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Are there other questions?
Well, maybe just because you mentioned to compare to our results, just that we took much smaller lambda.
Oh yes, here what we calculate is the small lambda and the small gamma and the small delta.
Yeah, I forgot what kind of lambda we took. It might be 100 or 1,000 or something. And then, because actually we did explicit summation, so we really computed the partition function. In that case, we didn't so look so much on the well, we did also put plots of the absolute value of the partition function.
Mm-hmm.
But even if this absolute value of the partition function was quite small and suppressed, we still found reasonable expectation values for the observables.
For the observables? Yeah. The area at the observables, correct?
The area and the deficit angle.
Yeah.
And we could get to quite large deficit angles.
Oh.
Compared to what you had. So we really had even epsilon equal to 1 or something. So.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if that's only because you have like 10 to the 11 compared to 10 to the 3 for lambda,
mm-hmm.
what we had, or if it's also because we looked at expectation values and not only at the absolute value
mm-hmm.
of the partition function. Because the absolute value of the partition function is really, even in our case, it decays very fast as a function of gamma, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
But even if it's very small, since you know the expectation value, we divide by two numbers, which are very small, we still find reasonable expectation values for the curvature, which approximates the classical result.
Yes, I see. I see.
And get much larger allowed.
That's it, actually.
Mm-hmm. Deficit angles whereas here you get really small deficit angles and I'm not so sure. Well, and plot only this absolute value, and I'm not so sure if that's only because you have these large lambda.
Oh, maybe it's a reason, because here what we choose the lambda is like a 10 to the 11 or 10 to the 13. It's too large.
Yeah.
Maybe we can choose some small lambda then to see. But I think we of course if we choose the small lambda, then the deficit angle will enlarge.
So as I said, we even when we have, I mean, we also see a very strong decay of the absolute value of the partition function,
mm-hmm.
what we look at,
mm-hmm.
but we nevertheless get reasonable expectation values.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just saying that looking at the absolute value of your partition function might restrict you too much.
Yes, maybe it's a good idea.
Even when this was decaying by 10 to the minus 5, and I don't remember exactly, but it was really even 10 to the minus 10.
Mm-hmm.
factor smaller than one, we still found reasonable expectation values for the curvature. Yeah. So that might have be that might be something on top of using smaller lambda, which helps to get quite large deficit angles.
Yes, I agree. Maybe we can try to calculate some observables, like the deficit angle as the observable or the area as the observable, to see maybe the number will increase, I think. But,
yeah, okay. And maybe last question. So you find these critical points completely numerically. You cannot put in an analytic parameter like gamma because it's a completely numerical procedure. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes, totally numerically. So here just use the Newton-like recursive method, numerically compute the complex critical point. And yes, it's not analytic because the dimension is too large. It's like for the delta 3, it's 124, and for the sigma 15, it's 195. So analytic solve the complex critical equation, it seems impossible to me.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you for your comment.
Okay, as I see no other raised hands, and I think we are also running out of time. Let's thank again, Dunshu, for the very nice talk and the discussion.
Thank you.
And,